Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Each week, we choose an interesting new book on some corner of the world of sports, and we interview the author. This week, we are looking at more than just a corner of the sports world. My guest is Andre Markovitz, and we are discussing his book, Gaming the World: How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture, published in 2010 by Princeton University Press. Andy Markovitz has had a long and distinguished academic career. He holds named professorships at the University of Michigan and has been a guest professor at top universities in the U.S. and Europe. For more than three decades, he has been a prolific scholar of comparative politics and political economy. Yet, as he explains at the start of our interview, the work that has gained the most attention is his research into contemporary sports. And the class he teaches that draws the largest enrollment is his one on sports and society. Andy understands this attraction to his work on sports. As will be clear from the start of our interview, he is a true fan. He is an ardent supporter of Manchester United, the New York Yankees, and every team that wears the maize and blue of the Michigan Wolverines. In part, his work as a scholar of sports is an effort to understand his experiences as a fan of sports. This is what he tries to convey in his book, in his classes, and in our interview, that there are much deeper impulses and much deeper social and cultural trends that shape how we watch and talk and think about sports. Andy's book covers a wide range of topics related to contemporary sports: racism, gender roles, class differences, and global capitalism. He also discusses the more mundane aspects of global sports, like why European footballers wear the baggy shorts and body tattoos inspired by American hip-hop, or why the White Stripes Seven Nation Army is heard in stadiums around the world. We tried to cram a lot into our conversation, and it made for a lively episode. So let's turn to the interview. Andy, thank you for joining me on New Books in Sports. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm quite honored.
So to start, I'll tell listeners that Andy holds named chairs in comparative politics and German studies at the University of Michigan. He's held visiting professorships at Stanford and Harvard, as well as universities in Germany, Austria, and Israel. And he's written and edited several books on politics in Europe and America. But it's really been just in the last decade that your research work has turned more to sports in Europe and America. So, Andy, I'll start by asking you, what led you to move from researching topics like the political economy of Germany to researching global sports?
Being a fat cat tenured professor who can pretty much do whatever he damn pleases. That's why.
I'm glad that you're honest. So.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful story, but there's a story behind it. The story, obviously, all of my work is actually very autobiographical in some ways. And it started off by my being constantly puzzled how my world of high-flying fat cat professors in the social sciences on both sides of the Atlantic were actually of literally almost the identical culture. We all read the New York Review of Books, and we all followed Habermas and Foucault and this and that and the other thing and political economy. But the huge divider between Berkeley and Berlin, so to speak, was only one. And I'm talking, of course, only among male academics and my male world, namely to the ones in Berkeley, Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio and Montana and whatever were completely understandable codes, and they knew what this meant, and they used them, and this was part of the world. And the ones across the Atlantic had absolutely no idea, zero, none, nada. And for them, it was, if at all, even though in Europe for reasons that I probably won't have time to go into. Academics are much less into sports or the equivalent of academics, but still, for them it was Puskás and Fritz Walter and whatever, AC Milan, on and on. And I was very kind of puzzled by this all the time. And, of course, my work was always comparative, a professor in comparative politics, and I implicitly and also explicitly looked at certain comparisons between the United States and Europe on many things, not sports, to be sure. I wasn't a fat cat tenured professor then. Mm-hmm. Then in 1986, I was a professor, get this, on teaching on a cruise ship that went from Vienna down to the Black Sea and then to Istanbul. And this was for graduates of American universities, but actually alumni, I should say, mm-hmm. and actually most of them quite old because it was very expensive, and there are these tours all over the place for various alumni. And interestingly, it was, of course, the time of the World Cup in Mexico and the NBA Finals in the U.S. between the Boston Celtics and the Houston Rockets. Mm-hmm. And what was so amazing to me is that my world on this boat for 2 weeks literally became an upstairs, downstairs, very much following the British, wonderful British soap opera that we all grew up with. Namely, upstairs, the men around in this world were, of course, all obsessed about the Boston Celtics and the Houston Rockets. And in fact, I remember missing some important tour of the Budapest Art Museum because we're all busy trying to find an International Herald Tribune to find out what Game 3 was or whatever. At the same time, late at night, at 1 a.m., I descended into the bowels of the boat and hung out with Russian, Ukrainian, and Bulgarian waiters, sailors, whatever, mm-hmm. With whom we watched the World Cup from Mexico. And I speak a lot of languages, but I do not speak Russian or Ukrainian or Bulgarian, but yet there was a common language. Mm-hmm. Even watching teams that had nothing to do with these countries, I don't know, mm-hmm. Mexico playing Paraguay or something. And I was just sort of really struck by this. And I went back to, then I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I had this summer free, so to speak, and I sat down and wrote an article, researched an article which was called The Other American Exceptionalism, Why Is There No Soccer? Mm-hmm. And I loved doing it, and then to my amazing surprise, I was invited to deliver this paper at the very fancy schmancy State and Capitalism Since 1800 study group at the Center for European Studies at Harvard. And first of all, I was amazed that, you know, I would be invited with this topic. I mean, I was a member mm-hmm. of the center, but still, this was, you know, really a high-flying, cutting-edge stuff in political economy. And not only was I invited, but the audience, it was packed, totally packed. And people just really loved the discourse, the debate, and took this very seriously. Make a long story short, the article was published, and to this day, it's my most successful article in terms of it being having been translated, I think, into 12, but maybe more languages, Persian, Hungarian, whatever. And so, clearly, you know, I really have tapped into something mm-hmm. in the sense of looking at sports, not in a micro way, the way it had been for a long time, namely injuries or kind of often psychological issues, which is perfectly fine, and sort of kinesiology and so on, but really looking at sports as a form of larger sort of macro societal questions about what it has to do with the working class and with sequences and so on and so forth. And this then led me to use my fellowship at the very fancy Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin at the Wissenschaftskolleg in 1989, 1999, to take that year and basically write the book Offside, and which became sort of a mini classic, as it were. And that sort of spawned this, as I always, to this day, say, basically my world of the sports world is sort of like a hobby in some ways. I mean, I love it, and I do it full time now on some level. But of course, I still teach courses on fascism and on the European left and whatever else. And some of the sports thing is like how should I put it? It's sort of a kind of a very serious leisure endeavor. and it's been absolutely wonderful. And I really think it's apart from being wonderful to me, I really think that, not I think, I know that through the study of sport, you can really learn a lot about basically the macro culture and society of the place that you're actually studying. Mm-hmm.
So probably a more interesting question in regard to your background is how you talked about that European scholars are generally not as interested in sports as American professors. So I'll ask, how did a boy from Temeswar who grew up in Vienna, so certainly you're a fan of European football, but you're also a fan of American football and baseball and basketball. So how did you become a fan of American sports?
That's a very important question, and I think it's absolutely essential in understanding my Americanization. And when we arrived in 1960 in New York, I argue that sports knowledge and sports fandom is immensely path-dependent, meaning the earlier you learn it, just like sports to me are languages, the earlier you learn, the better you speak it, and the more nuancedly you speak it, and the more aware you are of its beauty and of its meta part of the language. And so, as I always say, I'm a very, very advanced and very knowledgeable and very fine soccer speaker. I'm a almost equally fine, advanced baseball speaker. I mean, knowing already yesterday that Tony La Russa made a big mistake taking this guy Mott out. I mean, you just know this, okay? You just—I don't know how, but you know, it's you know why certain things in German are that and this in English. And basically, when we arrived, and I was 11 years old, my father took me to a Yankee game, and Baltimore Orioles, and 1960 Yankee Stadium, and this was a very, very important experience in my Americanization. And interesting, I will never forgive, and never sort of one of the highest sort of thanks that I have to my father for many things, but one is that he actually realized that this is an important language to learn to become an American. And even though he himself was way too old and actually never really understood baseball and found it boring because it was not his language, just like Americans find soccer boring because it's not their language. If I were to speak Hungarian to you, you'd find it boring too. He still took me to these games, and so I learned baseball very early on. And then when we moved back to Vienna, I spent every summer, that's very important, in the U.S. So I became actually a huge Yankees fan and baseball fan because I spent the summers here. And I'll never forget listening to the 1962 World Series and Willie McCovey's line drive to Bobby Richardson and the Yankees winning Game 7 against the Giants. I listened to this on American Forces Network on this transistor radio late at night in my bed in Vienna. So baseball was very much part of this. Interestingly, you should ask, football is already, I'm a fine football speaker, but not nowhere near of the nuance of soccer and baseball. Why? Because I learned it when I came to Columbia and when I really finally came to the United States for good in 1967 as an 18-year-old. And yes, of course, I noticed it that in terms of my fandom, yes, I became, because I lived in New York, and New York was America for me, so I will always love New York teams. But my love for the Yankees is exponentially higher than for the Giants. I mean, it's just, yes, of course, I'm a Giants fan, but it's just a different, I can't explain this, but those who of your listeners who will, I think some will understand this, that the depth and hence the depth of my love for Manchester United, which I have had since February 6, 1958, the terrible day in Munich, mm-hmm. when my father and I heard about this in Romania still. We were still in Romania. This actually tied me to United forever, mm-hmm. and 2 years later, Yankees. And these associations are immensely powerful. And then basically football, basketball, hockey were, again, once you learn one language very well, and I would say that they're actually all in some ways related, and especially if you learn, let's say, a Romance language well, you speak French, then it's not so hard to pick up Italian and Spanish and Portuguese and whatever, Romanian. Will you know the poetry of those? Probably not. So yes, of course, I know my football and hockey history, and go to the Hall of Fame. I know this, but really, kind of understanding and feeling the game the way I do in baseball and soccer, no, not really. So when I go with a really advanced, like our next door neighbor, who is the assistant general manager of the Pittsburgh Penguins, but lived in Ann Arbor, when I go to a Michigan hockey game with him, it's like a different level. I mean, mm-hmm. he sees things and tells me stuff that I just don't. Mm-hmm. But so basically, it's a form of it's a form of communication, a form of passion, mm-hmm. And it's also, of course, something that is so essentially, how should I put it? It's a form, certainly for men, and probably only for men. It is a form of communication which is class transcending, mm-hmm. and ethnicity transcending, and all kinds of other dimensions transcending. So, when I arrive at Heathrow Airport and take a London cab, and the cabbie is from, Gujarat or Punjab or whatever, and we speak cricket, mm-hmm. which I'm also conversant about, not very much, but I know the game, I follow it, I'll be, of course, watching next Saturday night for us, or Sunday morning, the Rugby World Championship final between France and the All Blacks of New Zealand. Mm-hmm. I'm an omnivore, mm-hmm. and I just, again, don't know these nearly as well as association of football, namely soccer or baseball, but it's something that is still important to me. And when I talk to this guy, this aforementioned cabbie, sometimes it's so much fun that I hope that the traffic jam will last longer, and I not be dropped off in London at my destination. And in a sense, you actually get out of the cab, and there was a very human interaction. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what sports provide, that is amazing, because actually I know nothing about him, zero. I don't know, whether he has kids or no kids, or whether he's lonely, he's this, that, nothing. I actually know nothing about him. I just know that he understands why the West Indian team of the 70s and 80s was so good, and da, 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 on and on and on. And you have a sort of human interaction, mm-hmm. Which is a certain form of, dare I say, even intimacy. I mean, mm-hmm. Kind of a, the barroom talk, the something that a Punjabi cab driver and an American, Romanian, Hungarian, Jewish origin professor would not have in common, zero. And yet they do, because of this, of sports. And I think that's immensely powerful stuff.
Yes, this is something I really found interesting about the book, and you elaborated on this idea of sports as languages much more than in the book. And as you said, you just as with spoken languages, you gain fluency if you're introduced to a sport as a language early in life, whereas you can gain a measure of a functional knowledge or a conversant knowledge if you begin to study a language later on. And so you obviously have the approach of a polyglot, of someone who wants to learn languages, the languages of sports, and who's willing to, thinking of when you start learning a spoken language. You have to start out and you make mistakes and people correct you. But it is really it requires a measure of bravery to talk with someone from South Asia about cricket if you're just conversant in that language. But I want to ask you, because this is something you talk about in the book, why is it that many people, most sports fans, are resistant to learning a new language, whether in Europe or the United States?
That's actually a very interesting question, and I'm not sure I have really, in some ways I'm looking for the answer in this, because it's a certain form of tribalism.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, something that annoys me no end on both sides of the Atlantic. I can't quite explain it, other than ultimately, this is conjecture, because actually ultimately people don't like to learn languages either.
Yeah.
And those that like to learn languages are disproportionately of the more educated, you get the idea, more educated classes, more educated levels of society, more cosmopolitan. They've traveled more. They're not threatened by something new.
Mm-hmm.
And a new language is threatening, and so are sports. And however, now we're coming into this important class issue, the great sports language speakers are disproportionately of a lesser class. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not cosmopolitan professors. In fact, in their case, it's a kind of rare, let's be very clear, Bruce, back to your original question. I would never allow one of my doctoral students to write or do start working on sports in a serious way.
Mm-hmm.
It's still not kosher. Okay, so it's, in this case, coming back to my originally, you laughed heartily, which I appreciated. But it's still not, all of these books are post-tenure books. I wonder how my academic career would have developed, let alone blossomed, had Offside been written in the 1970s
mm-hmm.
or early 80s when I did not have tenure. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure about this. So, back to your point, I think that people are reluctant to learn Spanish and are reluctant to learn, whatever. And in that sense, I mean, they must or they have to, and they do, and then some people love to. And in fact, in sports, it's starting as well. But I think your gut instinct is one of threat. And I totally agree with you. This always brings up. And the other day, I watched PTI, and I actually kind of liked Michael Wilbon, interesting guy, and mm-hmm. Northwestern graduate, and obviously good journalist. And he and Tony Kornheiser, whose shtick is, of course, to be much more kind of adversarial and
mm-hmm.
basically coming across as some kind of curmudgeon. But both of them, at some points, it's like, oh, too much soccer. And then Michael Wilbon, there was a question, Manchester United, Chelsea, and the thing, do you care? I said, of course not, because, of course, here we will watch our football, okay?
Yeah.
The point is, he's right about that. Most American football fans don't care about Manchester and Chelsea. But the dismissiveness, and the same on the other side of the Atlantic, this sort of dismissiveness, kind of seeing it as inferior, seeing it as boring, which of mm-hmm. course makes sense because you don't know it, their history, you don't know their beauty, their meta language, all the context that makes them all so great. What is so interesting to me is that they're all seen as somehow facile, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, how hard, I hear this in German, how hard can it be to hit a ball, with this bat? How hard? Very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very few people can. And if you hit it 30%, 30% with success, you're actually a Hall of Famer. You're mm-hmm. you're a star, okay? So the point is, or the other way around, how hard can it be to kick a ball? What's the big deal? So you have this attempt to code your own as unique, to see it as uniquely beautiful and to see any other as clearly inferior. And obviously, since sports is spoken much more by the people mm-hmm. and not by intellectuals, who are in fact, or should be, and often are, in fact, by their very being, much more cosmopolitan, have traveled more. But those guys don't care about sports, or much less than the people. And the people, of course, are threatened by new stuff. So that's how I basically, it's a sort of a class analysis, in my view, would explain why you are spot on with your question, namely, even in this day and age of globalization and the ability to actually consume these across borders, it's still resilient, and it's still basically a niche. Mm-hmm.
So sticking with the resistance to more cosmopolitan sports, you make a point in regard to soccer's popularity in the United States and soccer's prospects in the future, that for soccer, and I think you're referring specifically to Major League Soccer, for yes. soccer to succeed in the United States, it must gain the support of the average male sports fan, whom you describe as Joe Sixpack. So could you explain why you think that's necessary, and is it possible?
Wow. Let's start with the necessary and the possible. Necessary because, again, for historical reasons, all of these languages that we talk about were constructed in the 19th century. In the modern, I mean, yes, soccer, all these ball, the bat and ball games, baseball has, you know, predecessors all the way to the Inca. That's not what I'm talking about. You know, and all the various footballs go back to Shrovetide and, you know, Harpastum in Rome. Again, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about really when they become sort of modern sport. And they become modern sport in the latter half of the 19th century with leagues, and, you know, schedules, uniforms, all that. And this was, of course, an immensely male world. The Victorian age, for, again, reasons I can't develop here, but was an extra male world. In other words, women are pushed even further into the private sphere, having a lot to do with industrialization and so on and so forth. So, in fact, sports, not only in terms of their doing, but also, and here we're talking about the followers. In other words, mm-hmm. we're talking about the couch potato, and as you your question so clearly point out, and you read it very correctly, that's my world. That's what I'm actually explaining here. That's what I'm trying to explain. It's not so much the athletes. It's really me. You know, I mean, it's basically sports consumption. And this was very male. This is a world that it remains male. And it's a form of, again, back to the discourse in the London cab or in a Boston cab where, you know, we could have an unbelievably often phenomenal conversation about the baseball. Of course, I would never let on that, of course, I hope the Red Sox, you know, disappear in Boston Harbor as a Yankee. But you know, and then, of course, the guy would, you know, kill me. But other than that, it's basically, again, this amazing form of bonding in some ways. It's a club. And so it being, this is still so much being a male world, I would argue that for any newcomer to really be picked up and become part of the core and not remain on the ever-proliferating, and that's important, the ever-proliferating fringe, which has become more and more diversified, and the core in this case is sort of becoming, if you will, a tad smaller, which of course also means that it becomes more defensive. For that to happen, the carriers have to be men and have to be your regular, you know, Joe Sixpack, your sports guy, okay? And I'm absolutely convinced that this is sort of the one that you need to really succeed. Now, is this forever the case? The answer, of course, is not necessarily. It need not be the case because, of course, this core is indeed actually shrinking, or in fact has shrunk massively. The working classes of all these societies are not miners and manual skilled workers anymore, but are in the tertiary sector. By the way, increasingly female, or in fact majoritarianly female, which in fact also I see as a form of yet another form of attack or a kind of a defensiveness on the part of men, which, by the way, I link in the book and in my mind clearly to, for example, soccer, to the hooligan and violence in Europe, mm-hmm. where basically the soccer stadium has become the last sort of bastion of unmitigated maleness, mm-hmm. and where you can really let it out, which you cannot in the rest of society. And so in that sense, no, I mean, if women, or in this case in America, sort of, by the way, I have great hope with the Latinos, but our Latinos are, again, not your core Joe six-pack. But if women and new social formations, so to speak, behooving the 21st century, really would embrace this sport, then in fact, it might very well be a different social carrier that produces and catapults it into the core. But at the moment, I don't see it. In other words, women are, you know, again, in many ways, totally to their credit, but women construct sport differently. Mm-hmm. You know, as I in this new book, you know, even the sportista, which is a pun, of course, on fashionista, and someone who not only loves fashion, but actually knows fashion. So even women who love sport and know sport talk about it differently. If you want, they're much more multitasking, much more multilingual than their male counterparts. And, you know, and so as long as the commitment or this, if you want, fanaticism or whatever you want to call it, is not there with these new carriers, but only the old carriers have that, my argument is that you do need Joe Sixpack, maybe you know, more of a Hispanic version of Joe Sixpack to in fact catapult soccer into the core of North American sports culture. It's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And again, just I'm repeating myself, but as long as women and are not as committed to this, I don't see it taking on beyond. I'm talking about on a quotidian day, on a daily basis. I'm not talking about events. Events have become immensely successful. Mm-hmm. If you look at the television ratings of the World Cup, and certainly when the U.S. team is playing, but even the Women's World Cup, they're unbelievable. They're off the charts. Some of the World Cup ratings from 2010 were at the high, basically like World Series numbers, NBA Finals numbers. But that's, to be crude about this, this is basically event-driven. Mm-hmm. And basically Jerry Seinfeld's, you know, we're rooting for laundry. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're following the U.S. team, which is perfectly legitimate. It's fine. But, you know, it has to become something that people really worry about, what the LA Galaxy are going to do in their derby against Chivas, or mm-hmm. you know, again, back to the sports radio, the constant talk about why the coach is an idiot for mm-hmm. doing this and that, and having Landon play more slightly on the right than on the left, which of course he is a complete nonsense, and on and on. And this is not the case yet. Yeah. And I would argue, it seems to me, that the only way that this might, that it will happen, is if the men's national team wins a World Cup, or, you know, loses in a final in a glorious game, a 4-3 against Brazil or Germany or Argentina. Then that will be the catapult that really will link up the amazing supply that exists, like your daughter, yeah. and millions of others, that has really spawned and developed in this country since the late 1970s, early 1980s, and link the couch potato to this world, mm-hmm. Which, by the way, I'm becoming more and more and more convinced are almost, they're not totally separate, but there's only a minor overlap. that really following sports the way I am and the way males are has only in some ways tangential relationship to it being played. It really is a form of obsession. I would actually go even further, and you know, this is terribly highfalutin, but it's like mind games. It's an intellectual pursuit. It's like collecting, knowing all the presidents, knowing the capitals of the world. And in fact, in the new book, I spend quite a bit of time looking at the sociology of nerddom, a certain form of male. Male, precisely anti-sport. In other words, the guys who are into this, the fantasy and all that, is really a form of a discourse which, if anything, is not only non-sport, but almost, I linked it to it, really was struck by this and started doing a little research on nerds and how nerds, of course, are also highly male, but of a very different dimension, namely, you know, kind of cerebral, out there collecting useless stuff, whatever. And that's what this to some degree is. And if you look at the whole notion of fantasy football and fantasy and all of this, I mean, just the name alone says it all. This, again, by the way, is heavily, heavily male. There are some women who play in leagues, no question. But again, there's not enough research. But from what I could tell, most of them actually play sort of together with men, or you know, it's not they don't, you know, and they play absolutely, but not the way, you know, some of my friends who are fantasy players, to whom this is an all-consuming pursuit.
Well, let me ask, what is the European version of Joe Sixpack? Is it the hooligan? And what is this male white fan resisting in Europe?
The hooligan is one aspect. Okay. But basically, no, it's your male committed soccer fan who, unfortunately, by virtue of right-wing extremist politics that sees the soccer ground precisely because it's male, in the early 70s created a world which is very ugly, and where, by the way, the United States is massively ahead in terms of racism being completely off the table. This is not the case because, in fact, obviously, part of sports fandom is, of course, taunting. It's all about taunting, and it's all about making the opponent who visits your holy ground feel as uncomfortable as possible. And that exists in America too, except with one major exception. You can't, for things that I'm immensely proud of, racism is off the table. There's no banana throwing. You cannot deride someone for his race, which is an amazing, it's amazing. I think that is phenomenal.
Well, it's not limited to racism. Can I jump in? It's not limited to racism. I think of, just a few weeks ago, Arsenal fans taunted the player from, is he from Angola? From Togo, who the Arsenal fans were saying, you should have been the one shot in Congo, which isn't necessarily... isn't necessarily racist, but you have that tradition in European football. You know, you had talked about the tragedy with Manchester United, and that you have fans who are still rubbing salt in these tragedies that people suffer. I would say this is something you also wouldn't see in American sport, that kind of vulgarity and just jumping on someone's suffering to make a taunt.
Yes, totally. I totally agree with you. I mean, the constant. I mean, in fact, Ferguson, Sir Alex, just this past Friday. I mean, a week ago from today, you know, went on public, said, "Please, you know, it's the big game coming up with Liverpool. It's the North England Derby, whatever, the biggest enmity. Just please stop the chants about Munich and the plane crash, and you, Man U fans, stop the." You know, constantly chanting and making fun of the Hillsborough tragedy in which 99 people suffocated to death. I totally agree. And look, you're in this case, one thing that I loved about, I went to the Women's World Cup this summer, And one thing I love, Bruce, is that I noticed after only the second or third game, I said, why am I going to these games with just joy and it's fun? And I suddenly noticed, whoa, I'm going to these German soccer fields not feeling, you know, mm-hmm. on edge about something. You know, in the subways, it was fun. People were, you know, kissing, dancing, cheering. It was families. It was a joy. It was wonderful. Something that you don't have.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. I mean, the taunting, but the taunting exists here as well, although not as brutally, because, you know, again, for reasons that have something to do with the civil rights movement, with a form of public discourse, and, oh, very important, the presence, the greater presence of women in American venues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, women, let's be very frank here, Bruce, you know, women are civilizing agents.
Yeah.
And they just, you just don't. You don't, you behave less badly in a world in which your sister, daughter, cousin, girlfriend, mother, whatever is around than when they're not. You know, there are some ugly taunts, you know, trust me, at a, you know, a Michigan-Ohio State game.
Yeah.
And, you know, definitely. And actually probably more so in Columbus than in Ann Arbor, but in both. So the taunting is there. It's just what has become somehow off limits.
Mm-hmm.
And there I agree with you. It's racism plus. I mean, about the Angola, I did not know about this Arsenal thing that you explained. But I think it's still in some ways a form of racism. You know, it's about killing, but it's all over Europe. It's become a bit better in the top leagues. No question, they've cleaned it up to some degree. But in the lower leagues, it's still very bad. I mean, eastern part of Germany, absolutely abominable. Neo-Nazi chants, all of this. You know, this is part of a. It's not that women aren't part of it. Of course, there are, and we know of neo-Nazi women as well. But ultimately, it's a form of unbridled maleness, mm-hmm. and kind of making these sports, these hegemonic sports, kind of a space of. Not only making the opponent uncomfortable, but sort of basically a space in which one can say things that in every other realm of contemporary Europe are out of bounds,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the state, in terms of civil society, in terms of your workplace, and on. And what else is the most sort of the most outrageous taboo that you can constantly invoke? Obvious, the Holocaust. So the continued constant taunting about in various ways about the Holocaust, about gas, about this and that, which you have across the board, Poland, in Russia, in Germany, in Holland. You know, it's again very ugly, very bad. In that sense, I'm glad that this is less the case in the United States, although. In the larger context of taunting, which of course goes back to the whole issue of winning and passion.
Mm-hmm.
The reason, of course, there was no taunting, the reason why it was so wonderful to go to the Women's World Cup, because ultimately people didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they wanted the U.S. to win, and they wanted their team to win, and of course Germany was completely going crazy about the German team. By the way, I'm absolutely convinced one of the reasons they lost was because I've never seen pressure like this. I mean, it was basically fait accompli. I arrived before the tournament. I was giving lectures in Germany. It was basically a done deal that the Germans will win the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Done deal. Nothing that would happen with the men. And, of course, with the men, there would be much more debate constantly, you know, for months, you know, why the coach is an idiot and who should play. This did not exist with the women. Most Germans didn't even know the starting 11. They didn't know them. Okay? So clearly it was important that, you know, they knew that they were a good side and they would win, period. And, you know, they lost. There was a bit of a kind of a letdown, nothing. And when I talked to the I've sort of followed the ESPN truck and occasionally talked to Bob Lee, whom I know quite well, and also to Brandi Chastain. So I remember in Dresden waiting for them, and there was this guard, this German security guard that the ESPN hired to follow the truck around. And so I talked to him a little bit, and I said, so how has this been? I said, oh, my God, this was the easiest gig I've had in ever. I said, what are you talking about? He said, it was wonderful. I said, have you ever, was there ever any trouble? I said, trouble? Are you kidding? I mean, you know, people dance around and come paint and, you know, ask Ron to see Brandi, and she signs autographs, and it's just, there was nothing. Hmm. So last night, it was the night after Germany lost to Japan, surprise, to everyone's chagrin and surprise, the worst that happened, like at 4 a.m., some drunk guy kind of started berating Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, mm-hmm. and really started misbehaving and, you know, ranting and raving against the German government. I mean, this was his only sort of, I mean, is it, what happened? Did you have to kind of wrestle him? I said, no. We just put him in a taxi and sent him home. I mean, it's a different world completely. Yeah. And because ultimately the women's game just does not come close to riling the passions. And I actually have just, I'm really thinking about how in many ways being a real fan is bad on some level.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I just before you called me, I was emailing a dear friend and said, you know, I love watching this Texas St. Louis series. It's great. I love it. I follow the strategy. It's fascinating baseball. I don't, you know, leave the television. I don't turn it off. I don't run around. I don't sit in a corner. I don't, swear. I don't berate people. I don't behave like a lunatic the way I do with the Yankees when they lost the Tigers. I was furious at Michigan and Detroit. I mean, they should, thinking of, you know, not going to teach them, whatever. I mean, complete lunacy. And it's so much nicer not to have these, you know, primordial passions that are obviously so essential to the sort of proliferation, but also the maintenance of this. And this obviously Joe Sixpack has to his sport and his team. And these are really, really serious. This is serious currency. And for this to be kind of challenged by a rival and maybe even superseded, this is a tall order. I mean, this is not an easy gig.
So you mentioned racism earlier with European fans, and so we've talked about the resistance in the United States to soccer coming across the Atlantic, and you talk about in the book various elements of sports culture that have gone from the United States across the Atlantic, and that's actually one of my favorite parts of the book in talking about baggy shorts and tattoos and so forth. But I want to talk about something, it's not discussed in the book, it's actually quite recent, an export from the United States to European soccer, and that's the idea of the Rooney Rule from the NFL. And so I was wondering if, do you think this is something that would succeed in the Premier League and in European soccer, this type of requirement that football clubs interview black managers, candidates for coaching positions, for manager positions? Do you think, is that something that will work in Europe?
It's a very good question, and I'm glad you asked it, because I actually want to use that example of how in a different world which is a passion of mine, namely I've written a lot about anti-Americanism, and which I find really, really powerful in Europe, but that's a different topic. But I think in this case, it's yes, I think it's a wonderful advance that the United States has, that the Rooney Rule, which means that you need to demonstrate that you've interviewed. Of course, this still doesn't necessarily mean that the person gets it, so that we know that even with the Rooney rule, there's all kinds of kind of particularistic dimensions that, in fact, can really undermine a universalistic intention. And so this is by way of saying that the Rooney rule, though great rule, need not ipso facto lead to the success that it's intended to lead to. So one can, in fact, circumvent kind of progressive reforms. But the very fact that they exist is in and of itself important. Will this succeed in Europe? Very hard to say. I'm very impressed that, in fact, that they even looked at it. Mm-hmm. And kind of realized it. I would think that this will succeed in the EPL.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much less certain that it will succeed in the Bundesliga or in Serie A or in La Liga, because they are less tied in some ways to the American discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget, just like the folks that you and I kind of berated earlier, namely our folks who are instinctively suspicious / hostile
mm-hmm.
to soccer, believe me, the equivalent exists in Europe to anything American, not only sports. A priori, whoops, it's American, so there will be a resistance to it. And then kind of, you know, little by little, it kind of seeps in. It really is a question of what these associations want. I mean, don't forget that in this case, it's not so much soccer is, unlike the American sports, is not only run by the leagues, it's run by these associations, mm-hmm. which is, by the way, that's another thing which is a little bit foreign to Americans now, that, you know, there is something above MLS.
Mm-hmm.
Hello? What is this? I mean, is there anything above, you know, David Stern? No, it's the, I mean, it just isn't. And, you know, American, Basketball USA is a different construct. It is
mm-hmm.
very, it's like orthogonal to it. It's really not above it. And if the associations take this seriously, the Rooney Rule might very well become important. Although, of course, one would have to look at the quantity of how many sort of black head managers, in this case in the soccer world, black managers are really available, because I think the quantity is important, as in everything. If it's just one or two, it can easily be sabotaged. If it's more, it's less sabotaged. And since there are many more blacks in the UK than they are in Spain or in Italy or in Germany, I see that as the most successful transfer.
Well, we're almost out of time, Andy, and I want to turn away from the book to actually ask about the course you teach at the University of Michigan. The course is called Sports, Politics, and Society, and I know it's a popular course. It draws a lot of students. And I want to ask to close, in teaching that class, what pieces of knowledge or questions do you want your students to leave with at the end of the semester to make them more educated sports fans?
Oh, wow. Great question, Bruce. And let me say that my heart and what I really want it to be is that they not be more educated sports fans, but that they be more educated consumers and viewers and analysts and critics of mm-hmm. modern culture in advanced industrial societies. And interesting that you should ask this, because in fact, by week two or three, I always notice, and I've taught this course in various guises, different titles, but I don't know, 6-7 times already, and invariably, Bruce, there is always by week two or three, there are a number of men here, very important, male students, who you can see are getting a little restless. Sort of like, you know, they kind of thought, And, you know, we're still talking about English working class history and you know, what is the modern state and how is it done? And, you know, we read Weber and whatever. You could just see, like, hello, Markowitz, I'm one of the, I thought we're schmoozing Yankees in this course. And we're talking, you know, Michigan football. What is this? What are you doing here? Okay? And I want them to walk out of that course understanding what a modern sports, how modern sports are, what the organization of the NHL is, what that entails, what how big it is, yet also how small it is, that they contextualize this in terms of how this is part of their modern existence as citizens. That's what I want them. I could care less, you know, in terms of them. By the way, again, some of the men, because actually for the first time, I actually even teach a section, because the honor section in this new configuration, all the course always has sections, and the honor students now have to be taught by the professor. Perfectly fine. I mean, it's amazing. You should see what goes on here. I mean, I always walk in, I said, okay, any questions about the readings? What, silence. And the, okay, the first question, you know, so what do you think should happen with this guy? I mean, it's always about something sports. And what is also very interesting, and yesterday I have only one woman in this section, and we went over the papers because as the section person, I grade the papers, and we went over them, and it was what is modern about sports and how are sports profoundly also pre-modern. Very difficult topic. Some of them had difficulties with it. Some of them did not. And this woman came in, and we talked, and at one point said, you know, it's very hard for me in this section because not also because I'm the only girl in the class. And I love your lectures. I love the reading. I learned so much. But in the section, it becomes, and my words now, basically, you know, guy talk. In other words, it's not about understanding modernity, the conflicts of modernity, you know, the role of charisma that sports clearly convey, the importance of tradition, how ultimately what we love about sports, even though these are unbelievably modern, legal, rational structures, but what we really walk away with is precisely the charisma, the uniqueness, the feeling, which actually has a very little to do with modernity. That's what she wants to talk about. So in fact, whereas the guys actually always revert. Some, I don't think, not only because to show that they're better, because that's what they associate sports with. Okay, they basically want to talk statistics, this, that, who will, including, by the way, also soccer now. Absolutely, some of these guys are completely up on Arsenal and what Arsenal's problems are and why Wenger should be fired and whatever else. And that's actually what I don't want the course to be. So my hope is, and I think I've succeeded fairly well, to sort of show them that via sports, you can really get a very interesting angle and insight into the complexity of modern society. And when, you know, if you know, some student goes to a game 2 years hence and says, oh my God, you know, this is, it, oh wow, he's right. You know, I learned about this by reading Weber and Durkheim, and oh, I remember this, and yes, and then what happens with these charismatic moments, great. Or when they really look at how Europe is different from America in terms of racism, and the next time they go to an Arsenal game and see or hear what you just told me, or compare it to their experience in Philadelphia, great. That's what I want to in the course. Not so much, you know, they're, you know, if those that have no knowledge about the details of sports come to the class, of which there are a number, and walk away not having the details of this of these sports, that's perfectly fine with me. I mean, I'm not, I don't want them to know batting averages. I don't want them to know this. I do want them to know that sports are immensely meritocratic. Sports are what you bring on the field. And if that is great, you are, in fact, rewarded for this. And sports is a very important medium for an upward mobility. Mm-hmm. That's what I want them to take from the course.
Mm-hmm. So to finish, I'll ask, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on this book on. I just finished this book on female sports fans and how they are different. How, in fact, sports remains in many ways the last bastion of male exclusion. Precisely by virtue of it being so democratic, I argue, and actually we argue. I had a wonderful former undergraduate woman who actually, the book is about her in some ways. I mean, and explaining this sports-obsessed young woman who's now at the Michigan Law School, University of Michigan Law School, and how, how precisely because there is no credentialing in sports fandom, meaning there is no sports university that gives you a credential, you in fact are, anyone can be an expert, and every bar guy is an expert, and you are very easily, the bar of entry is not clear, and the barrier can always be shifted, and my argument is that actually men always do, and they constantly. So I interviewed a number of over 50 women about this, and what is so interesting, and also women sports journalists, is that for women, the barrier of entry is actually constantly raised and never clear. And unlike, and I looked at other highly male-coded professions or entities such as mathematics or physics or there, at least there is a credential. So a woman walks into a room full of male physicists. They might not like her, but she comes with, BA, Caltech, PhD, MIT, case closed. She is a credentialed physicist. There ain't no such thing in sports speak or sports talk. There is no MIT and Caltech in, being a fan or being knowledgeable. And this leads to this very, very amorphous form of entry in which women actually are not ever taken seriously. And so that is a big part of the book. And then, of course, the whole notion of, for women, the whole issue of beauty, which is a very, and the whole notion of body and beauty, which makes it very, very complicated and difficult. On the one hand, beauty being a necessary qualification to become a sports journalist in the visual media, yet if you're too beautiful, it immediately disqualifies you as a babe. In other words, beauty is inversely related to any kind of intelligence. And so that's what the book is about, and I loved writing it. It was great, great fun, and very, very interesting research. And then I'm also working on this one thing about, I'm fascinated about home field advantage. And I don't know how I'll approach that, but I've already collected a lot of stuff on that. And above all, this thing about how status of an institution bleeds over into its sports entity. So the hypothesis being that universities in the United States with higher status are there, and their main rival that is less of lesser prestige, those fans are much more unforgiving and much more taunting and much more rabid and much more angry. So in other words, yet another American exception, namely the world of college sports, in which aspects of institutional identity, which have nothing to do with the sport per se, play a crucial role in your existence as a fan. And this is everybody says it's a wonderful project. I have no idea how to ultimately be able to do this short of having millions of dollars and surveys. But at the moment, looking at websites and, I have no idea where this will lead, whether this will be just one article or mm-hmm. a book again, no idea. Mm-hmm. But again, the beauty of all this is that as we started in the beginning, I'm a fat cat, full professor, and I it's amazing. I'm, enjoying every minute of it. Great questions, and I think also important in terms of larger issues of social science.
Well, you certainly don't fit the stereotype of the fat cat tenured professor who's just kind of sitting idly in his office, enjoying the fact that he can never be pushed out, no matter how little work he does. So you're certainly very busy, and I look forward to, in particular, the book about women in sports. I look forward to that. Thanks a lot for being on the program, Andy. This was a book. I mean, we just barely scratched the surface of the notes I made, the questions I had. So I found it really to be a fascinating book. I enjoyed it very much. So thank you for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you very, very much, Bruce, for having me. I just totally enjoyed this. The time flew by way too fast. We should continue it in this forum or others.
You've been listening to an interview with Andre Markovitz about his co-authored book, Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture, published in 2010 by Princeton University Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from public policy to popular music. If you like what you heard here, please link to the Facebook page of New Books in Sports, where you can offer your comments and find links to thoughtful, shorter sports writing from around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your week.